Our next matter on calendar is 65853, Vergara Martinez versus the State of Nevada. If counsel is ready to proceed, please come forward. Please state your name for the record, and if you wish to reserve any time, Ms. Dickinson.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Armando Vergara Martinez. In his appellate briefs, Armando has presented this court with a list of numerous serious errors, which cumulatively and individually show that his right to due process and double jeopardy were violated at his trial. Beginning with the first issue, this court must decide whether double jeopardy was violated when he was convicted of mayhem and battery with substantial bodily harm. Well, this issue was decided in the Jackson case in footnote 8. In that footnote, the Jackson court said, because mayhem has historically been treated as an aggravated form of battery, a fair reading is that the legislature authorized conviction of mayhem or battery with substantial bodily harm, but not both. Well, I would have thought that that would have precluded the conviction for both in this case, but it did not. What happened here was the state began amending the pleadings during trial. And the purpose of the amendment was so that they could try to avoid the double jeopardy issue. And the court discussed it with them, and they finally came up with an amendment after about 7 or 9 witnesses had testified. And this amendment changed the body parts. So the court and the state believe that by changing injuries to body parts, he could be convicted of both mayhem and battery with substantial bodily harm.
As to that central issue, is the state allowed to amend as long as they don't add new charges?
They are. However, in this case, technically it was a new charge. Because if you go back and look at the justice court record and also comments made at the beginning of the trial, the state seemed to infer that he could not be convicted of all three. In fact, I believe such a statement was made right at the beginning of trial, and then there were some amendments done. So even though they can amend in this case, on one hand they're saying he can't be convicted, and on the other hand he is convicted. Looking at the unit of prosecution for battery, which is where I think the district court and the state were looking when they decided this did not violate double jeopardy, a battery is a willful and unlawful use of force or violence upon the person of another. It's found in Chapter 200 in Crimes Against a Person. The legislature did not say in this statute that a battery was each and every punch, each and every injury, each and every cut. Doesn't say that. It says the use of force or violence. This language indicates that it's a continuum of an event, not just one injury. So we submit to the court that when the state started changing body parts, and the district court agreed, that was an erroneous application of the battery statute. Moreover, in this case, he is charged with substantial bodily harm, convicted of that. And substantial bodily harm means bodily injury which creates a substantial risk of death or which causes serious permanent disfigurement or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any body bodily member or organ, or prolonged physical pain. This is almost the exact definition of mayhem. Mayhem is defined as consisting of unlawfully depriving a human being of a member of his or her body or disfiguring or rendering it useless. Thus, even the Jackson Court has said the legislative intent was that you couldn't be convicted of both, and the elements of the crime under Bennett-Berger show the exact same thing. So either way, this conviction for mayhem must be dismissed because...
And Ms. Dickinson, I think I was just looking. It looks like Judge Silver ran everything consecutive.
She did. She
so did. It's important. It has a significant impact on the sentence.
It does. It does. Mm-hmm. Not only did these changes violate double jeopardy, and they were states' way of trying to get around Jackson footnote 8, they violated Armando's right to due process, because during the trial, after witnesses are testifying, all of a sudden there were these amendments. And these amendments were important because the defense attorney had already conceded two counts in opening. So when they started amending, that changed the type of the count.
I think we understand your argument on
okay.
that. Could I ask you the one on the prosecutorial misconduct issue? I know I was trying to understand exactly what happened about how counsel for the state testified and presented that argument, but it looks like it was not objected to by trial counsel.
It was not.
Okay.
It was not.
So we're looking at plain error here. So why don't you tell us why you feel that's plain error.
Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct Rule 3.7, subsection A, say that the prosecutor cannot act as a witness in a case. The ABA standards relating to the prosecutor function require the prosecutor to interview prospective witnesses in the presence of another witness so he can bring that witness into court to testify for impeachment. In this case, the critical issue was whether or not Armando was intoxicated and could form specific intent.
Counsel, that issue is an issue within the issue on that, because I thought that part of the premise of the defense was that he was intoxicated and therefore he could not form the specific intent necessary. So I'm having problems with these two concepts of one, they shouldn't have commented, but yet the defense is asserting he was intoxicated and he couldn't form the specific. Tell me why I'm misplaced or why I shouldn't be confused.
Okay. My argument is that when Sergio, Armando's brother, testified that Armando generally drank every day, he had a drinking problem. The state asked him, when you were with him that morning, you didn't see him drink. And he responded, usually he would drink. Then the prosecutor said, well, do you remember talking to me and Miss Graham? Because he was trying to impeach him with a statement that he made in a pretrial interview. And Sergio said, yes. And he says, do you remember telling us that you didn't see him drink that day? So he was using what he heard in the pretrial interview and making himself a witness.
Having said that, and I understand that testimony, that banner back and forth and what was done, as I said, the theory of the case for the defendant as to his ability to formulate intent, which has been offered by the defense, why is this prejudicial or an error in light of that?
Well, the state was saying that he changed his statements and that before Sergio said that Armando had not had anything to drink or he was not aware of him having anything to drink.
I understand that testimony, but as I'm saying, wasn't the position of the defense that he had been indulging and he could not form the intent because of that?
That is correct, and the prosecutor undermined that defense when saying, don't you remember talking to me and Miss Graham? Don't you remember telling us that you didn't see him drink that day? So he specifically undermined the defense by claiming that Sergio was not telling.
Let me ask you this, though. It was a question, as I understand. We had this issue with Alan Dershowitz on Monday on a civil case, but if you ask a question that maybe assumes facts and evidence, it's still the counsel's question is not evidence. Do you think that makes a difference here? It's the answer, it's the evidence.
Well, it makes a difference here because the prosecutor is a representative of the state. And he's clothed with this higher type of authority where the jury is going to say, oh, he knows something.
What was the answer?
The answer was, do you remember talking to us? Yes. Do you remember telling us you didn't see him drink? Well, on many occasions, he would hide it in order to avoid having me see him drink. But he usually would drink every day. And he kept asking, and then the prosecutor said, but you indicated to us that on that particular day, you didn't see any, correct? And then he responded, no, not in front of me.
Was there other issues of prosecutorial misconduct that you raised?
Yes, there were other issues in closing. The prosecutor used these statements that Sergio supposedly said to him to argue in rebuttal closing when we didn't have a chance to dispute anything. But when he talked to me and Ms. Green for the first time, he said there was no indication of alcohol. He acknowledged that that wasn't something that was relevant at the time and that any indication had either been drinking or discussed about alcohol. So he used this in closing to go ahead and destroy Sergio's credibility. And there's the jury instruction that says if the jury believes a witness has lied about one thing, they can disregard all of their testimony. Also, in closing, he misstated the facts. I mean, this is a seasoned prosecutor. He said he brought the machete down on the back of her neck, almost beheading her. There was no attempt beheading. I mean, the medical records do not support that, nor do any of the eyewitnesses say that is what they saw. That's a separate issue with regard to the medical records that we did object to coming in.
How would you say would be the proper way for Mr. Giacomo or Ms. Graham to impeach a witness who said something during pretrial and then changes on the stand? What should they have done?
Right. If the witness denies it, I would say that they'd have to bring in a separate witness who was present there.
Well, if only the two attorneys are present, should you have Ms. Graham, the co-counsel, then withdraw and testify?
I suppose she could, but the ABA standards say if you don't have another witness there, you are precluded from impeachment. So I would suggest that the court follow that. I see I have like 3 minutes.
You have 3 minutes and a little above three. Do you wish to reserve that?
I reserve that.
Thank you. Ms. Graham?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Elana Lee Graham, and I represent the respondent in this case, that is the people of the state of Nevada. In Jackson, this court examined two separate cases where it looked at a single act of violence, one act of violence, and determined whether somebody could be punished for multiple crimes adjudicated and sentenced for that one single act of violence. The analysis in Jackson does not apply to the facts in this case. These were multiple acts of violence, distinct and separate acts of violence, that when the defendant, in essence, bludgeoned Maria with this machete, she suffered separate and distinct injuries, all which had separate and distinct impact. Specifically, he struck her multiple times at the base of her neck, split open her skull, her brain matter was exposed, in addition to another blow that severed her arms, or severed her hands, in essence, from her wrist.
So why did you have to keep on amending the charging document? Why isn't it back to the criminal complaint that was filed in Justice Court being the same as what the information is that the defense prepares for trial?
Sure. The information was originally filed in district court after the defendant backed out of a negotiation for just the attempt murder with use of a deadly weapon. The facts were sufficient to amend for the battery with use of a deadly weapon as well as mayhem. So, in all honesty, we could have left the original information as pled, and had we done that and never made a single amendment, the result would have been the same. Because, albeit there were an abundance of body parts alleged in counts 1, 2, and 3, ultimately, if there was never an amendment, he could have been convicted of all three and sentenced on all three.
So why would you take a chance and amend it and create an issue for the defense in an ice-cold case? I don't understand that.
Well, I don't think it does create an issue. If anything...
Well, it is an issue. I mean, here we have it in front of us. We wouldn't be talking about it if you hadn't amended the information.
Well, I understand. The purpose of a pleading is to put the defendant on notice. And the NRS that talks about amendments, 173.095, talks about that you can do it at any time up until the verdict is rendered, so long as it doesn't add a charge or affect the substantial rights of the defendant. In the case that tells us what's a substantial right of the defendant, that's Verre versus State. A substantial right of the defendant in reference to amending an information is, does the defendant know what he needs to defend against? So he knew from the very beginning of the filing of the information. And the main issue defense takes issue with is the count three, that all of a sudden the hands are alleged. Well, that was in the original information. It was hands as well as other parts of the body. In essence, what the state did is go from here, you're on notice, to down here. You were always on notice of all of these, and now we're getting more specific. And I don't think, Your Honor, that that creates an issue.
Well, let's say we do find that it's double jeopardy. Do we send back the case to be retried completely with the charges, or do we just strike the mayhem, or do we strike the battery? How does that work
well,
to find double jeopardy?
In order to find a violation of double jeopardy, Your Honor would have to find that when the defendant struck Maria multiple times, that all of that is one act. Because that's what double jeopardy is, preventing dual punishments for a single act. And you simply can't. One cannot get there in this case. And I think it's indicative when, obviously, as most of you know, as a district court, when you sentence somebody, when a district court sentences someone, you have the discretion to look at that offense. Does this kind of seem like the same thing? I think it does. So counts two and count three, I'm going to run that concurrent. In this case, all of the facts support a multiple act. And if you have multiple acts in separate punishments, there is no double jeopardy violation. The fact that he was sentenced consecutive for everything indicates that these were multiple acts. All of the facts and evidence indicate multiple acts. All the witnesses testified seeing the defendant strike Maria multiple times, and the injuries are spread about the top half of her body. So in order to find a violation of double jeopardy, this court would first have to find that somebody can bludgeon a victim multiple times and just be punished in that that could be characterized as just one single act. And to be forward and forthright, I don't think that's justice or fairness for a victim who's actually struck five or six times.
But it is your position that if we don't look at the amended information, that we go back to the original information that was filed, not the one that was for plea negotiations, the person could be, that this defendant could have been convicted of mayhem and of battery.
Absolutely. Counts one, count two, and count three never changed. Count three alleged striking Maria about the body, including head and or arms and or hands with a machete. I would submit when the jury gets back there and they look at count three and they have the instructions of mayhem, they probably look at that and say, well, her hand or her head wasn't really rendered disfigured. She doesn't have permanent loss of her head. They stapled her head up, her hair grew back out, her brain matter was fine. But when they go to look at the fact of, so they could say the state didn't meet its burden because her head wasn't permanently disfigured. They didn't meet the burden of mayhem. But hands and arms was always in count three. So then if it was never amended, they could still go to count three in the original information and look at the facts submitted and say, yes, when the defendant struck her on her arms and her arms were in essence amputated from her hand, from her wrist, that met the standard in the elements of mayhem. So that's without any amendments. And what that tells you is if the information was never amended, the result would have been the same. Any error would have to be harmless and certainly not plain because it wasn't objected to. And the reason the state poses why it wasn't objected to is because the defendant was on notice from the very beginning, which is the purpose of the pleading, which is why the amendment is allowed at any time until the verdict is rendered.
So if we accept what you just said about it being, if it was error, it would be harmless, what about the prosecutorial misconduct? Doesn't that put us in the area of cumulative error then in this particular case?
Well, no, and that's because there wasn't prosecutorial misconduct in this case. The question was posed to Sergio, the defendant's brother, do you remember meeting with us in our office? And I think Your Honor was on to it when the real inquiry is, well, what's the answer? What is the witness's answer? Because if he sat there and lied and said, no, I told you until I was blue in the face that he was drunk that day and that he drank all the time, the state would be stuck with that answer. The state would be completely stuck, and we'd be looking like buffoons. And it's a risk that we took. Nothing prevents us from asking a witness a question, and then if it's something that we observe, if we have a good faith basis to ask it, nothing prevents us from asking that. Sure, it's a risk that we took, and if he would have lied to us, we probably would not have withdrawn one of us to then impeach him. So that's not prosecutorial misconduct. There was an allegation of prosecutorial misconduct for arguing, misrepresenting the facts that the defendant tried to behead Maria.
That was not objected to.
And the reason it's not prosecutorial misconduct is because he brought a machete, a heavy, large, about a foot-long machete that the jury saw photos of, down on the back of a woman's neck, wherein her skull was split open, her brain was exposed. The doctor testified, who was qualified to testify, overseeing 100,000 trauma patients in a year, that what likely happened is Maria put her hands behind her neck to protect her head from being removed. That's evidence that this man tried to cut this woman's head off. So there's no prosecutorial misconduct where you try to impeach a witness. You have to give a witness an opportunity to lie or tell the truth before they can be impeached. In arguing facts and evidence, the facts that this man tried to cut Maria's head off, that's certainly not prosecutorial misconduct. If there are no questions or other issues that Your Honors wish for me to touch on, then I would submit it.
I know the defense has raised, the appellant has raised a lot of issues. Venue change, for example, did you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that in this case, first of all, no venue change was posed.
Well, we can't do a venue change. You have to have a jury seated first, and then find, and the judge has to then determine that the jury cannot be fair, and then you change venue. The only person who's ever got that on in the state is me, in the McKenna case in 1980. So there's a way to do it, and certainly they didn't do it right.
Sure, they didn't move for it, and I don't even think that had they moved for it, it would have been appropriate in this case.
Justice Scalia's clarified that on the issue of the graphic photos.
Sure.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, interestingly, the argument the appellant raises is that they were shown in opening, yet they were properly admitted. It's important to note that some photos the state wanted to put forth were objected to, and the district court decided to keep them out. In this case, we had to prove substantial bodily harm, and we had to prove mayhem. Mayhem is an injury which renders a body part useless, in essence. Mm-hmm. And specific intent to kill. Yes, the crime scenes were, photos were gruesome, they were grotesque, they were disturbing, but as were the defendant's conduct in this case, which we had to show. Specific intent to kill in an attempt murder case is not necessarily very easy, and so demonstrative evidence such as a photo that shows the aftermath of the defendant's attempt to kill is not an error.
So you don't feel the judge abused her discretion in admitting those photos?
I don't, and actually she exercised quite an amount of discretion when she refused to admit a number of photos the state sought to admit. With the defense objection, she sustained that, and a number of photos were not presented to the jury.
No abuse of discretion as far as you're concerned?
Correct.
How about the jury instruction that the appellant requested regarding specific intent?
Well, the jury instruction that was suggested by the defense and ultimately rejected by the court talked about a defendant's ability to form specific intent. When you talk about an ability to form specific intent, what you're really talking about is a defendant's mental capacity or lack thereof, diminished capacity, which is something the state does not follow, and it hasn't since 1957. So the instruction was properly denied, and what was proper was to instruct them on intoxication, where the jury can always, and the state did not object to it, always consider a level of intoxication in determining whether a defendant actually did form the specific intent. But when you talk about the ability to form specific intent, that's a different question. That talks about mental capacity or lack thereof. and that's something that wouldn't be appropriate. We do not have diminished capacity, and it wasn't, I don't think, an attempt to confuse the jury, but while it wasn't an attempt to do that, I think that's what, in essence, it would have done for the party, for the defense to say, well, let's look at whether he had that ability. That's diminished capacity. It's something that we don't have. And so they were properly instructed on voluntary intoxication.
Great. That's all my questions.
Sherry, anything else?
Nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Dickinson, rebuttal.
Ms. Dickinson, let's say we agree with you that we have error. Why is this cumulative error as far as the prosecutor misconduct and the amending of the information? Why is it cumulative? Would the decision have been any different?
I believe it would have, because most of the error focused on the intent, the specific intent issue. And that was the big defense that these trial attorneys put forth. He just simply did not have specific intent because he was intoxicated. That was the reason they submitted the jury instruction, which is not diminished capacity at all. It had to do about his ability to form specific intent based on intoxication, which is different than diminished capacity. So that's why I believe it's not harmless, and that cumulative error, it should be remanded back because of the cumulative error.
Now, are mayhem and battery both specific intent crimes? Or are they general intent crimes in the state of Nevada?
That's a good question. mayhem is pled as a general intent crime here, and battery is the general intent crime. However, at one point, the court ruled that there could be an intent of malice. However, the court later seemed to retreat from that. And in the Jackson case, I don't believe said it was a specific intent crime. So the court has kind of wandered around there. I want to point out one thing, though, that about the changes in the wording, and that the facts were changed between the beginning and to the end. The mayhem was changed. Initially, it was head or arms, and then it was changed to arms or hands. Head or arms or hands. And the second count, too, was changed totally several times. And even the first one was changed.
But you can have a pleading conform to the evidence, is what Ms. Graham says. Was she wrong? I thought that's a rule.
Not after the witnesses that testified. The defense has gone up and said, you know, we're not challenging these two. They were not challenging the way they were pled. And so then the changes come. So that's a serious problem.
Of course, the trial attorneys did not move for a continuance time to meet the new charge, what they considered was a new charge. They didn't ask for a continuance.
No, they did not. No. No. Did the court have any other questions about any of these issues?
Dickinson, in light of what Justice Cherry has offered, if you had to write the decision, how would you write it?
Well, I would write that mayhem is a lesser included of the battery was substantial, and that would need to be dismissed. But I would also write that the entire case needs to be remanded for a new trial because of the prosecutorial misconduct that occurred from seasoned attorneys and because of the changes in the pleading documents. There's numerous evidentiary issues, problems here, too. The court allowed this beheaded evidence admitted through the medical records, which violated our right of confrontation, and they allowed Dr. Coase to testify to speculation. Thank you.
Can I ask one more question?
Just go ahead.
That venue issue, Ms. Dickinson, when was that venue issue raised before the district court?
It was not.
So Justice Cherry's comment that you actually have to impanel a jury before it can be changed, that never was requested after the jury was impaneled?
No, I don't recall it being raised. However, I put it in the brief because the district court was so concerned about protesting. She had the jurors come in through the dock. in the back, and she was giving instructions to all the people in the audience. So the district court was very concerned, and therefore I felt the court could sui sponte change venue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just as a thought, if you watch out what you wish for, because in this state, if you change venue from Clark County, you end up in the rules.
Thank you.
With that, this case will stand submitted. We thank counsel for both sides for their arguments, illumination of issues, and clarity as to what is before this court. We're in recess till 11:30. Thank you.